Angelo for doing part of my work, because we've had both yesterday and today a primer on the basics of collapse theories. And I'm going to assume that everyone in the audience has a general idea of how they work. What I want to talk about today is, suppose some collapse theory is true. GRW or CSL or something like Daniel's relativistic generalization of it. Suppose some collapse theory like that is true. What kind of world is described by such a theory? And the interesting thing is that the answer isn't quite as simple as one might think, and there's actually some debate in the literature about that. David already quoted Bell from a article called Are There Quantum Jumps, which was written after Bell learned about the GRW theory, and he thought it was really cool, to the fact that either the wave function is given by the Schrödinger equation isn't everything or isn't right. And collapse theories take the second form of that dilemma and says, yeah, no, the wave function as given by the Schrödinger equation isn't right. It has to be modified. Implicit in that is that on a collapse theory, we don't have to add extra structure, that the world can be, well, the wave function is a mathematical thing. So we don't want to actually say that the world is the wave function. But we want to say is that the world is whatever it is that is represented by the wave function, and we don't have to add anything else like Bohmian trajectories. Or in the relativistic case, the quantum state of the world. Okay. And I want to talk about that. As Rowey said, the GRW theory is one in which the ordinary unitary Schrödinger equation is punctuated by occasional abrupt collapses. And it's cooked up, as David already emphasized, to so that a single isolated particle will undergo collapse very rarely, but it will the theory will suppress the sorts of superpositions that we want them to suppress, superpositions of macroscopically many particles separated by a macroscopic distance. Okay. All right. Angelo and David also mentioned the continuous spontaneous localization theory developed by Philip Perl. That one way of thinking about that is, it's as if there's lots and lots of little collapses, which sort of a limiting case of lots and lots of little collapses, each of which has a minuscule effect. And the nice thing, instead of instantaneous collapses, you have some extra field that couples to the wave function, and you give a stochastic law of evolution. Okay. Now, what I want to talk, and there are others, as Angelo mentioned, those are the theories that I'm most familiar with. What I want to talk about is the issue of interpreting. So if I give you any collapse theory, give me any initial wave function, give me a Hamiltonian, give me the values for the parameters, then what the theory does is it tells us, probabilities for what's going to happen. There's a probability distribution over what's going to happen to the wave function. And what I want to talk about is, suppose a theory like that is true, and we don't want to add any other structure beyond the wave function. How do we take that as a description of the world? The collapse postulate you get in the textbooks, which these theories are meant to mimic in appropriate situations, is that when you do a measurement, the quantum state collapses to an eigenstate of the thing being measured, and that's the result you get. And so when you first hear about these collapse theories, you might think that, in a Schrödinger cat experiment, or take a simpler case where you've got a pointer which it threatens to be in a position of pointing to plus and pointing minus, what the theory does is just simply erase one of those terms, and everything's fine. The pointer is pointing to plus. If you've been listening very carefully to what people were saying, though, that isn't quite what happens. What happens, in the GRW theory, is that the wave function gets multiplied by a Gaussian, and Gaussians have tails. So what you have is almost all astronomically high percentage of the amplitude associated with this, and virtually none of it associated with alternatives. But virtually none is not zero. So on the naive collapse postulate, you can say, well, I know what it means for a quantum state to represent a situation in which some observable has a definite property. It has a definite property if and only if the quantum state is an eigenstate of that observable. And if collapse theories yielded states that are in fact eigenstates of the sorts of observables we care about, then I don't think anyone would ever, be giving talks about how to interpret collapse theories. We think we know how to do it. So that's what I'm saying. Now, this is known as the problem of tails. David and Barry Lower wrote a paper with the nice title of Tails of Schrödinger's Cat, Tails of the Wave Function. It persists in these other theories. I think there's good principled reasons to think that we're not going to have a theory that does what the naive collapse postulate wants it to. So, so suppose we're in a quantum state, and if any theory like this is true, which isn't, exactly an eigenstate of this chair being here, but it's very close to it. How do we interpret that? And there are in the literature about this, and there is literature about how to interpret collapse theories, there's basically three kinds of proposals that I want to talk about. One is the proposal that is favored by Girardi and his co-workers. And basically what that is you take the wave function, or take the quantum state, you define a mass density, I'll have the definition on the next slide, I think, and that's basically your description of the world. The mass density, you get a certain mass density, a determinate mass density. I can associate a certain amount of mass in any region of space at any given time. And so what would happen is that in a situation like this, you would have, if this is a pointer that with a mass of 1 gram, you'd have so close to 1 gram it doesn't make a difference here, and virtually nothing else here. But not zero. So for this table, the mass density associated with the table, take a spatial region which you would think would in fact contain the table, and the theory tells you that almost all of the mass associated with the table is in that region. There's another proposal on the table, which Bell proposed in this article I already mentioned, the Are There Quantum Jumps? I don't know if he really took it seriously or not. He introduced it for certain technical reasons. It's gotten known, it's known as the flash ontology. And I'll say what that is in a moment. And then there's a paper in a volume dedicated to Abner Shimoni called Tails and Stuff and Nonsense, which I like a lot, by someone named Philip Pearl, where he outlines a more complicated ontology, which I'll talk about in a minute. And so let me just talk about these things first. And There's a certain kind of way of talking about this that's become common in the literature. There was an article published in the British Journal for Philosophy of Science by Valya Lorry, Shelley Goldstein, Roddy Tomolka, and Nino Zangi. And they introduced this terminology, primitive ontology. And since then, philosophers, at least, who've been talking about this have tended to adopt that kind of terminology. And you know, what is primitive ontology? Well, the idea is that any given physical theory, if it is a physical theory, is going to have to be about something. And the primitive ontology, as opposed to ontology that might be defined in terms of the primitive ontology, is, in their words, what the theory is fundamentally about, the stuff that things are made of. And a lot of people take these three proposals I have here as different choices of primitive ontology. I just want to make a comment because sometimes in these discussions, people say, well, you know, what's so special about quantum mechanics that you need to say something about how the mathematical apparatus latches onto the world? And I don't think that this is special to quantum mechanics. In any physical theory, we write down a bunch of mathematical stuff, and we say something about what in the world it's supposed to represent or what relation it's supposed to have in the world. You know, when you're doing classical mechanics and you're talking about the solar system, you know, you say, well, you know, let big M be the mass of the sun, let little m be the mass of Jupiter, you know, let XS be the position of the sun, let XJ be the position of Jupiter, and you write down your, you know, equations of motion there. So, you know, as you're writing down the stuff, you say what the heck it is supposed to represent. So that's always there. And we don't spend a lot of time talking about that in classical mechanics because, you know, what I just said seems to be completely unproblematic in classical mechanics. Okay. So this is the mass density definition. You've got, you know, whatever kinds of particles there might be, you know, so you've got local particle number operators, and you just you define a mass density operator, which is just the sum over the local particle number operators multiplied by the mass of those particles. And then the mass density is an expectation value of that mass density operator. Typically, there's going to be some variance associated with that. But if you have a large enough, so if you integrate to the mass density over a volume, if I have, you know, large volumes, if something like this table, and I integrate over the volume associated with the table, the sort of quantum states that the theory leads to are going to be close to eigenstates of those, you know, macroscopic mass density volumes. Okay, and the nice thing about the mass density is this is defined at a place and time, and the idea is that ordinary objects are patterns in the density. This table is a sort of pattern in the mass density. There's a table-shaped region of high mass with low mass outside of it. Flash ontology. This is a quote from Bell, talking about the GRW theory. The GRW jumps, which are part of the wave function, not something else. So the reason for that parenthetical remark is he's counting this flash ontology as still on that horn of the dilemma where the wave function is everything, not something addition to it. Are well localized in ordinary space. Indeed, each is centered on a particular space-time point. So we can propose these events as the basis of local be-able-to theory. A piece of matter then is a galaxy of such events. Yeah, that's a weird idea, but you know, imagine, you know, you were to look at this room through goggles that showed up. You know, imagine the GRW theory is true, and you're looking at this room with goggles that showed locations of these hits. You know, where a GRW jump occurs as little green flashes. then simply because there's a lot more matter here, there'd be a lot more flashes happening where the tables are, and you see table-shaped patterns of flashes. Macroscopic objects, you'd be able to find, you'd be able to look at those patterns of flashes and say, yeah, there's a table there. Yes, there's a Richard Healy-shaped pattern of flashes there. That sort of thing. Okay. What we have in Pearl's view is those are kind of minimalist ontologies. And, Philip takes a lot more to be real. The idea is that if for any quantity, and, for simplicity, we're going to talk about quantities that associate with volumes of space, like that mass, like an integrated mass density open thing. But you can do it for charge spin, angular momentum, and whatever. Let's say this is a quantity that takes on certain discrete eigenvalues. We can say that the expectation value of that, of the projection operator onto that eigenvalue, is the amount of A stuff there. So if this is, the table, if the state of the world is close to an eigenstate of having whatever number of particles make up a table in this volume, then the particle number stuff associated with this volume, that expectation value will be very close to one, and we'll say that there's a lot of n stuff, where n is the number of particles in the volume in the table, in the volume associated with the table. And simpler example in cases where it's not close to an eigenstate, this thing is still well defined. So if I have an electron that's in equally weighted superposition of being in two places here and there, then there's something here and there's something there. But we don't want to say there's an electron here and there's an electron there, because there's only one electron. But the amount of one electron stuff is in this region is 1/2, and the amount of one electron stuff is in this region is 1/2. Okay. When do we say we have a table here? Well, Philip proposes is that we'll say that we have an objective reality of something when, as I've been talking already, we're close enough to an eigenstate of having that table hit there. So we introduce some threshold, and it can be very, very small. But when it's close enough, we'll say, okay, yeah, there's a table there. So epsilon is some very small threshold for power. Yeah.
So I still have difficulties understanding this one electron stuff, so to say. So it's neither just the epistemological wave function, so to say. It's nor is it the real electron, but it's not half the electron either. So what is this electron stuff in this worldview?
So what is it? I think the answer is that this is an attempt to take the quantum state seriously as a description of reality. And we're going to have to introduce concepts that are unfamiliar. And but we're nevertheless going to include our familiar concepts, like saying, that something is definitely here and there. But what do we say? What do we say about the world? What kind of world is it that where you have an electron in equally weighted superposition of here and there? That's a different situation from a situation in which there's no part of the electron's wave function here. So we want to say there's something there. What is it? I don't know how to actually. Here's what I would say, and in the discussion period, Philip can tell me whether he would agree with this or not. if the what is this one electron stuff? Well, if the answer is that you want, one might want is, tell me in terms of something classical and familiar in categories that I had before going to quantum mechanics, what that is. No, not going to do that. It's not. And it's like the situation in, there's a lot of concepts that get introduced as part of physical theory that make no sense outside the context of that theory, like energy, for example. And if you want to get a sense of what this concept actually means, you have to look at the theory and ask, what does it do? So what's the difference? So rather than asking what is it, I would say what does it do? And what does it do? Well, what's the difference between having, equally weighted superposition of versus, versus something where, it's, different things. So, maybe, 0.9, what's the difference between having, here and there, I want it. What's the difference between having a state in which we say there's a certain amount of one electron stuff here, say 1/2, and having a state in which there's more? Well, these states respond to detectors differently. Right? Like, if I put a detector here, I'm more likely to get a hit here than there. Among the properties of this stuff is a certain propensity to interact with other stuff in certain ways. Yeah.
Shouldn't it be the amount of one electron spin stuff or the one electron mass stuff or something corresponding to your choice of quantity?
Particle numbers count too.
So this isn't a relativistic quantum field theory.
What's that?
This isn't quantum field theory. Sorry then.
This is ultimately the story we want to tell is a relativistic story, yeah.
But we haven't seen that yet.
This is supposed to count for any kind of collapse theory, whatever the observables are in the theory. We want to be able to apply this kind of story to
but
it.
But couldn't there be a situation where you say there's an amount of one electron spin stuff in this region of the half, and there's an amount of one electron charge stuff in this electron of a quarter? Could that happen?
They go together. Yeah, they're going to be coupled. Right? What's that? Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. And one way to see it is that the charge density is just going to be a multiple of the particle number density, okay. Or the mass density is just a multiple of the particle. Okay. All right. Okay. Now here's a question I want to ask. I had what I called three proposals for finding the world in the wave function, or the world in the quantum state over there. And question that I think tends to get elided in these discussions, but I think it's an important question, because there's this question, which is the right ontology? An important question before we even start asking that kind of question is, what are we asking? Are these proposals three different, do we have three different theories, CSL, say GRW with mass density, GRW with flash ontology, and GRW with stuff densities? Are those three distinct physical theories which say different things about the world, at most one of which could be correct? It does sound like that, because they disagree on what the world is made of, what it consists of. Or can we think of those three proposals as agreeing on the underlying physical reality and simply different proposals of how to hang our talk onto that, in particular, our talk of ordinary physical objects? I call that the distinctive question. Do we have mutual exclusive accounts about the way the world is? Or are these merely different proposals about how to hang talk and ordinary objects on one and the same physical theory? And a lot of people who write about this, as far as I can tell, implicitly assume the former alternative. And my own suspicions lie that what we really have to do is, we don't have any fundamental disagreement about what the world is like on a collapse theory, but we're just trying to figure out how to talk about such a world. Okay. Now, this raises an issue which, it's a long-standing issue in the philosophy of science, goes all the way back to the Leibniz-Clark correspondence at least, but probably even earlier, is how do we tell the difference? When do we have on the, you know, we've got two things that someone might write down. When do we have distinct theories about the world that say something different about the way the world is? And when do we have, say, merely notational variants, or different choices of language, or different ways of expressing the same theory? And what I would like to be able to do is now invoke a well-established answer to that question of how to tell the difference between things that are genuinely distinct theories and things that are merely different ways of expressing the same theory. Apply it and be done. Thank you. You know, we'll have lunch early. Embarrassing fact is, even though people have been talking about these things for, 300 years or something like that, is that we don't have a nice, clean answer to that. We don't have a clean criterion distinguishing between distinct physical theories and variant formulations of the same physical theory. And I mean, the interesting thing in these discussions is there are certain things which everyone takes for granted are notational variants, like Schrödinger picture and Heisenberg picture of quantum mechanics. And there are other things that people take for granted are distinct physical theories, and which ones are taken for granted one way and the other. There doesn't seem to be a principal distinction in the way people talk about it. Now,
what about the standard answer of two theories are distinct if there exists at least some conceivable place where you could do an experiment and distinguish them?
Thank you. I paid him to do this because that was actually just the main point. This is a controversial point, and thank you for illustrating that. I think that's too simple. Certainly, if I can do an experiment to distinguish two theories, I've got distinct theories, yes. But could there not be two distinct theories that say, different things are going on behind the scenes, but, our ability to probe is just too crude to tell the difference? For some people think, obviously not. You're talking nonsense, right? If I can't tell the difference, then there is no difference. And for other people who said, well, actually, no. We're not, we're just not that important. There's no in-principled reason why there couldn't be, could there be facts about the world that are in principle beyond our ability to probe? If the answer is no, then I think, who are we to be so important?
Who are we to be talking about those fields?
Yes. That's another question. That's another question, and I think that's an important thing, because you might say, I might have two theories that say there are different things that are going on behind the scenes and we can't tell which. Let's not waste our time. Let's not waste our time talking about that. And I'm sympathetic to that, actually. You know, why not get to the serious business of doing experiments and finding out the things we can find out about the world? I'm cool with that. So if you say, yeah, there could be this distinct physical theories that nonetheless are empirically equivalent, but we shouldn't waste our time talking about that. I have no problem about those theories, you know, about distinctions of those theories. I have no problem about that. But I still want to be able to answer this question, when do we have that, and when do we have just variant formulations of the same physical theory? Because then, you know, if they are just variant formulations of the same physical theory, then there's nothing for us to, you know, be ignoring there. Good. And I actually know what way to, you know, I actually know a way to do this, but to look into individual things and ask yourself, what is this theory saying about the world? And is this one, and what is this theory saying about the world? And are they different? Yeah. Okay. All right. And the idea that all of this talk about ontology of collapse theories is merely a matter of choosing of ways to talk rather than distinct, you know, ways the world could be, has, you know, I'm not the first one to suggest this in particular. You should give credit for Peter Lewis, who has suggested that also. All right. Well, let me ask this. On the flash ontology, is there a mass density? Well, that quantity that I, you know, that I wrote up there is well-defined, you know, on as long as the wave function and those operators are well-defined. And also, even if it's not part of the primitive ontology, that mass density is actually playing some kind of role in the theory. You can measure it. You know, I can measure how much mass there is in a region. So I want to say that, yeah, there is at least something that that acts appropriately like a mass density on the flash ontology. To make the sense of the dynamics, you know, we need to have mass as a parameter in our equation, whatever basically equations are there. And, you know, even if it's not a primitive ontology, it's, you know, it's part of the world, even on a flash ontology. Okay. Actually, I want to skip this. All right. Now, for a while, I was happy thinking, okay, there's no, you know, flash ontology and mass density ontology are not different proposals about the way the world is, but are different ways of trying to hang our talks about macroscopic objects onto the world. And then I had, and I was happy with that. And then I had a conversation with Roddy Tomolka, actually, as he was writing this paper with his with his student, where they were doing, you know, they were looking at GRW and CSL and asking the sort of questions that Angelo was talking about yesterday, which values of parameters are excluded by experiments that we have. And they wrote this paper would have these diagrams. The ERR there is the experimentally restricted region, experimentally excluded region, experimentally refuted region, that's what the R is, yes. Experimentally refuted region, and then there's this PUR. So let me just say, these are different parameter diagrams for GRW with mass density and flash ontology. If two theories place different constraints on viable values of the parameters, then they're different theories. Now, so that, you know, that's what sort of woke me that considered
different classes of theories, right?
Different classes, yeah, right. That I agree, because to specify a theory, you specify the values of the parameters, right? So we have, yeah, for each one of these, there's a class of theories corresponding to various values of the parameters. And then within each class, you know, you specify a particular theory by specifying the parameters. I'm fine. Yeah, thank you for that correction. So yeah, these are different classes of theories if they correspond, if they produce different viable values of the parameters. Now, notice that the ERR is the same on, so the, you know, the shaded regions are supposed to be the excluded regions, the white regions are the still viable ones according to them. And they have this, they haven't said yet, yes, said that yet. The ER, experimentally refuted region, is the same. And what differs on these diagrams is this PUR. That stands for philosophically unacceptable region. And the idea is that if collapses and the vertical axis is collapse rate, and the horizontal axis is collapse width. The idea is that if there aren't enough collapses, according to the theory, so if the collapse rate is too low, then you know, we might do an experiment and have our experimental apparatus be in a superposition of reading plus or minus. We might then we might look at it and go into a superposition of seeing plus and minus, and you know, be in a superposition of writing down plus and minus in our lab notebook, and then the collapse happens. But there'll be a period of time when you know, we're effectively in a kind of many worlds kind of situation. And if you're going to accept that, you might as well, you know, be an Everettian and face all those problems associated with the many worlds. So that's the idea, that if collapses don't happen often enough, then we'll have periods of where we're in, you know, superpositions of having what we would regard as, ought to regard as distinct measurement outcomes. And, you know, then the collapse theory wasn't really doing what the collapse theory was supposed to do in the first place, which was to save us from being Everettians. Okay. And their criterion actually was that, you know, they're actually very generous when it comes to that, because, all they want to do is make sure that once you print out the result on a piece of paper, then it's not going to be a superposition of printing one and zero. And see, the worry is that, and the reason that so much more of, you know, we've got this line up here for low collapse rates. Which is so much bigger in the why the PUR is so much bigger in the flash ontology than in GRW, is that the mass density is always there whether there are jumps occurring or not. And so, you know, given a wave function, this table will be there. But if the flash rate is too low, then you know, you put on your glasses that show up the flashes, and you know, in this room there's going to be virtually no flashes going on, and you wouldn't say there's a table here in this room if the flash rate is too low on the flash ontology. And that's not acceptable, because after all, there is a table in the room. Okay, so that's the argument. And here's what here's a quote I might say. Macroscopic objects, say chairs in three-dimensional space, are to be found in the pattern of flashes. Since one flash occurs at every collapse, very small values of lambda mean that the flashes per second are too few to contain a chair, which makes the theory philosophically unsatisfactory. Okay.
What's the distinction between empirically computed and philosophically unsatisfactory? If there's a table here and then, and in the theory there's not, isn't that an empirical representation?
So there's a table here right now, and you're not in a superposition of seeing a table here and there. Right? right?
Yeah. Okay.
Now, if the flash rate is too low, what could have happened is when I said there's a table here right now, we could have been the superposition of seeing table, you know, table there, here, and table there. But a collapse occurs by the time I said right. And now, you know, you're in an eigenstate of remembering there being a table, but you know, because you've now collapsed the superposition. But for a while, you were actually in the superposition of seeing a table here and there. So have we? This has to do with this. You know, there's this.
Sounds like a two different notions of empiricism, which is right. Probably true, that it's not such a well-defined notion that people pretend that it is.
I think that that's right, because when you start worrying about these, you know, these things, you ask yourself, well, you know, you end up having to ask questions like, what counts as a measurement, right? When is a measurement over? We have to think, you know, we have to think hard about what we're going to, you know, count as the end of a measurement. And in fact, it's hard to say that the mere fact that we have definite experiences empirically refutes any parameter values, because, you know, it's sort of a limiting case where the flash rate goes to, you know, the interval between flashes goes to infinity, or, you know, the flash rate goes to zero. We get something like a many worlds theory, which there are people, I don't know if there's anyone in this room, you know, but there are people who say that many worlds theories are empirically viable. And if that's right, then we can't experimentally rule out mentally rule out low values of collapse rates. But we can experimentally rule out excessively high values of collapse rates, because excessively high values of collapse rates will suppress certain superpositions. And if, you know, the idea is, if I can exhibit interference between two terms, then I know I haven't had a collapse yet. So I can rule out excessively high values of collapse rates. Ruling out excessively low values of collapse rates requires you to have some idea of when a measurement is done. Right. And their criterion is actually very generous. They just don't want to allow your readout to be in a superposition of reading 10, you know, yeah, ink on paper, actually, you know, of reading 0 and 1 for more than a fraction of a second. Now, you know, most of us would say, you know, the measurement's done long before that, you know, long before it hits the printer. So you imagine you've got, you know, some, you know, say photon detector, you know, coupled to some kind of device that sends a signal to your computer that you know, records something on the hard drive, then you print it out. Yeah, presumably, as soon as the detector's involved, then there's a collapse, if there is a collapse at all. Okay. So that's, you know, that's the difference between experimentally refuted and philosophically unsatisfactory. Philosophically unsatisfactory is if the collapse rate is too low, you might as well be an Everettian. Right, yeah.
So on that point, collapse rate is, say, once a year for us.
Mm-hmm.
We experience collapse once a year.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Objects.
Yeah.
Then, I mean, it's true that we might be in parallel worlds for a year on average.
Right.
But you've still got probabilities acting, Z Once a year, we experience the program
Right.
happening
right.
exactly as one mechanics predicts.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's a good point, because one, as David mentioned, most people think, one of the big problems with Everett is trying to make sense of probabilities at all. Right? And if I had a collapse theory in which we had collapses, then that gives us definite probabilities. But they happen only once a year, then, you know, effectively, you know, let's say it happens on New Year's every day, a big collapse, you know, effectively for a year, you know, we're walking around in these superpositions and we're in many worlds, but, you know, at the end of that year, we collapse to a definite outcome, and we can actually ascribe probabilities to those outcomes. And at least some of the conceptual problems of the an Everett interpretation go away. So yeah, I mean Feldman and Tomoka would regard something like that as philosophically unsatisfactory. I'm happy to leave that as an open question. Okay.
What you the quantity you are say you interpret in an ontological way is usually a mass density or something like that. But the thing is that before you compute the mass density, for example, you need to evolve the wave function. Mm-hmm. Now, if the wave function itself has no ontological meaning, then what is the purpose? What's the point of having ontological meaning of a mass density, for example? The mass density is being produced by the evolution of the wave function. So the only logical way to approach the problem is to try to assign ontological meaning to psi itself, not to something else like mass density.
I agree with you, except for that not in the last bit. Right. I think that all of these proposals are ways of making sense of a theory on which there is nothing else but the wave function. So we're assigning ontological meaning to the wave function on all of these proposals. But the question is, what sort of ontological meaning do we assign to it? How do we get talk of, because, you know, if the world, if everything there is in the world is what is represented by the wave function, what I then want to show is that, having said that, I have the resources to represent tables and chairs, right? Because if I can't represent tables and chairs, then I don't know how to talk about a world at all.
What other wave function on the table and chair?
Right, yeah. So when do I have a wave function that says there's a table here, and when do I not have a wave function that says I have a table here? Like, so what kind of wave functions are, so this is the question. The world is just a wave, what is represented by the wave function. Which wave functions are they that say there is a chair here? And which wave functions are there that say there's a chair here? And which wave functions are there that say, no, the chair isn't in the definite position, this is a superposition of being here and there? That's the question that's being asked. Yeah, David.
There's actually a lot here that I'm puzzled about, but I'll reserve most of it for discussion after.
Okay.
But just to follow up on the last question, I don't get it. If the attitude we're taking here is that as you're doing two things, and I don't see how they fit together. Mm-hmm. One thing is, these are all there is the wave function, mm-hmm. and all we're doing here is playing around with what kind of resources we have to make connections between the wave function and table and chair talk.
Right.
Okay. But on the other hand, it seems like as if you're one of the people who's taking the primitive ontology seriously, you feel that we need to make some choice between them, and we need to compare them, and so on and so forth. So you're drawing these diagrams about which ones would be philosophically unacceptable and which ones wouldn't be philosophically unacceptable. And I don't understand, given the first part of your attitude, why you would be doing that.
Of course, good.
Let me just say, once you take the first attitude, Of course, you're going to use whatever resource works, whichever of these resources
okay.
works best.
Okay.
It doesn't involve making any philosophical commitments. It doesn't involve making any metaphysical commitments. There's no
okay.
issue.
Good, 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 good. Yes,
okay.
exactly. That's where I was headed.
Okay.
So, you know, so basically, the structure of the talk is, well, my inclination was to say that, you know, these are just choices how to talk on the world. And I was, you know, then I had this conversation with Roddy, and he was talking about these diagrams. And I'm not the one drawing these diagrams.
Okay.
It, you know, Feldman and Tomolka are there, and saying, well,
you sounded impressed.
Well, I was, I wanted people to at least, you know, understand why, you know, this gave me pause, at least temporarily. But yeah, if you can draw different diagrams, then they must be distinct classes of theories. Prima facie. So this would be an argument, and you know, this would be a consideration that prima facie seems to be in favor of distinctness. But then when you think about what the difference between those diagrams are, they're the difference between not the, you know, between what you're counting as P you are and what you aren't. And then once you think about what the difference of diagrams are, then the inclination to think that these diagrams mean that these different choices of primatology are distinct theories, I think, tends to dissolve. So suppose, I know I'm running out of time, but actually, when did I start?
The whole session is at least another, and at most 10 minutes.
At most 10 minutes. Okay, so let me just wrap up fairly quickly, because I do want to have some time for discussion. Imagine that we were in this region that's, you know, according to Feldman and Tomolka, philosophically unacceptable on the flash ontology and acceptable on mass density. Well, what would the world look like? What would this room look like? Well, there'd be a wave function. And the wave function, and there would be this, you know, not primitive, but derived mass density of the wave function, which has real dynamical significance, so you can't say it's not real at all. And it would form table-shaped regions. There would also be charge densities, you know, defined in the same way, and analogously to the mass density things. And you know, the region, this table-shaped region, would be one that's mostly on a large scale is electrically neutral. So if you smear over large volumes, charge density averages out to zero. But if you get to finer scales, it's not zero and fluctuates wildly. And that's actually very important because, you know, the reason I'm not just going through the table has to do with the repulsion of outer shell electrons in my hand and in the table. And the reason you see the table has to do with electromagnetic interactions between the light and those electrons. So all that stuff would be going on. There just wouldn't be any flashes there. And the claim is that there's if the flash ontology is a distinct theory, the claim is that I can imagine a theory that says all that stuff is going on, but there's no table there. And I think the natural thing to say is, well, you're just mistaken about what it is to be a table. Because there's something in there that acts like a table, and you're just saying it's not a table. Well, okay, that's just, you know, an inappropriate way of hanging words on it. And I want to end up with a fable, which I think that goes back actually to the beginnings of modern science, but I think is worth remembering. There's this, and so this will be my end. This is in a manuscript, with that Latin title, which translates to "On the Gravitation and Equilibrium of Fluids." But everyone who talks about it just calls it "The Grav." It's a manuscript by Newton that was not published during his lifetime. It was, I think, originally published in early 60s sometime. And one of the interesting things about this is some of the discussion, in particular discussion about nature of space and time and matter, is a precursor to the scholium on space and time that ends up in the Principia later. One of the things that, when he's writing to Grave, Newton, who grew up in a very Cartesian intellectual background, is making a break from that. And he tells this fable. And I interpret this fable as him giving reasons to reject a certain tenet of Cartesian metaphysics, namely that the essence of body is extension. And Newton says, well, imagine that God decreed that a certain region of space was impenetrable. And moreover, that region of space reflected light. And moreover, there were laws according to which that region of space moved around, and laws according to how quickly you could change its state of motion depending on how hard you pushed it. That would count as an object, a table-shaped region of space that repels other objects and reflects light and obeys certain laws is a table. But strip away all that and just leave extension and you haven't got a table. And the moral of the story is that I think, if I want to ask what a table is or what an electron is or what a photon is, you can't get away from talking about what it does, what kind of dynamical role it plays in the theory. And there's all this stuff in in any collapse theory that plays that kind of dynamical role that is actually missing on both the flash ontology and the mass ontology. Is it enough to be a table to just have a mass density? Well, if it had no electromagnetic properties, we wouldn't know it was here. Yeah. I mean, yes, I'm interacting gravitationally with the table, but if that would be its only properties, I'd be just going right through it. I wouldn't see it. So really, it is everything that a table does. What is a table? Well, it's all those things. It's a region of space with a certain mass, a certain electromagnetic properties, other properties that it has. And there's no reason to pick out one of those things and say that is what the world, the stuff the world is made of. All of this, it's built into the theory that all of this other stuff is important and plays a dynamical role. And we should take the lesson from Newton that, pay attention to the theory and let the theory tell you what sorts of things are candidates for being tables. And the answer will be very much dependent on what sorts of thing, what does the wave function do? What properties of the wave functions play what kinds of dynamical roles? And so what I want to say is that, even though I don't think of these as different choices about the way the world is, but they're merely different ways of talking about it, if you're only going to talk about the mass density, you're going to miss out an awful lot, and you're going to miss out on, in fact, an awful lot that's important about the table. So even if these are just different ways of talking, some ways of talking are better than others, and there's absolutely no reason, and a way of talking that restricts ourselves to one kind of property like mass or charge or something like that, the exclusion of others, is just going to miss out on a lot.